Isaiah chapter 13:1 to chapter 14:23, the 11th talk in a series on Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on October 7, 2012 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at Isaiah's chapter 13 and 14. We finished the first section, the introductory section to Isaiah. That's chapters 1 through 12. And in that section, God lays out his case with respect to Judah and Israel, the case that he has against them, and explains that there, because of their rebelliousness, there is going to be a period, a protracted period of time, it seems, where they are going to suffer all kinds of things as God tries to wake them up with respect to their rebelliousness. But that in the end, Israel and Judah will come around, and they will be made into something. They will be faithful to God, and they will serve a truly glorious role in the world. So that's what was spelled out in the first 12 chapters. Now we get into another section, starting with chapter 13, where a curse is going to be proclaimed on the various neighbors of Israel, each in order, each in turn, and that goes for 10 chapters. The first one is with respect to Babylon, and we'll look at that one. When I was working through this passage, I was thinking along one track till I got to the end of this section, at which time I decided that's not working. And I went back and rethought the whole thing. There's some tricky interpretive issues here with respect to how to interpret prophecy, predictive prophecy, which I take this to be. And so we'll talk about that stuff after we go through the passage. But it's probably good that there's a lot of time today. There's the potential for lots of questions when we get to the end. I really encourage you to see this as kind of a workshop and encourage you to be thinking through this. And as questions come to mind, jot them down or remember them, and we'll talk about them at the end. Chapter 13, first 5 verses. The oracle concerning Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amoz saw. Lift up a standard on the bare hill. Raise your voice to them. Wave the hand that they may enter the doors of the nobles. I have commanded my consecrated ones. I have even called my mighty warriors, my proudly exulting ones, to execute my anger. A sound of tumult on the mountains, like that of many people. A sound of the uproar of kingdoms, of nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts is mustering the army for battle, and they are coming from a far country, from the farthest horizons, the Lord and his instruments of indignation, to destroy the whole land. Okay, we're told that this is an oracle. The word that's translated oracle means, literally, it means a burden, but it's used in this context of a kind of burden that's given. It's a burden that gives insight into, in this context, a burden that gives insight into what's coming. This oracle is concerning Babylon. So we know that from the outset, but that has to be a little bit strange insofar as Isaiah is writing this in about 700 or so, maybe a little bit earlier than 700. We don't know exactly. But Babylon at this time is not a significant country. Babylon had been the most prominent kingdom in the world from about 1900 BC till about 1600 BC. But then it is supplanted by other kingdoms in Mesopotamia who take turns controlling that area, and Babylon is left out of the rotation for a while. So Babylon is a conquered kingdom at this time. It is part of the Assyrian Empire at this time. It is not an independent and powerful entity. So this has to be a little bit strange to the listeners that this would be an oracle concerning Babylon. What it says, how it starts out, is the same way that we've seen two other passages so far in Isaiah start out. Lift up a standard on the bare hill. We've seen a standard lifted on two other occasions. The first one was in chapter 5, 26, when it talks about it, a standard being lifted and warriors being called to the standard. On that occasion, it apparently was talking about the Assyrian army and the soldiers being gathered in order to start out on their expedition to the west and ultimately to defeat Israel and Syria. The second time that a standard is mentioned is in just the chapter before, I believe. Yes, chapter 11. Verse 12, he says, "And he will lift up a standard for the nations and will assemble the banished ones of Israel and will gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth." So in that occasion, it was a standard that was raised that called to it all of it's the Jews, it's the descendants of Abraham being called from all over the world, being called back. So on that occasion, it was a joyous thing. On the first mention of a banner was a kind of ominous thing. And here in chapter 13, once again, it is ominous. We don't know who's being called to this banner. We don't know what their intentions are. It's just a wind-swept bare hill that has a standard on it. And it's calling his consecrated ones to it. It says, "Raise your voice to them, wave the hand that they may enter the doors of the nobles." So apparently the standard and the voice are calling people to the standard. I'm not sure what to make of "wave the hand that they may enter the doors of the nobles." My best guess is that what's being described here is an assembly of soldiers. It becomes clear later that these are soldiers. An assembly of soldiers who have been given permission to go into the house of nobles, which suggests that maybe this is something that is happening that is hostile to the noble families, hostile to the aristocracy. It's not clear, but I'm suspicious that that's the kind of thing that's being described. Then he says, "I have commanded my consecrated ones, mighty warriors, my proudly exulting ones, to execute my anger." By consecrated ones, it doesn't necessarily mean these are holy people in the sense of good. They are set apart ones. They have a mission. So these are people that have an assignment from God that are being assembled. Mighty warriors, so these are competent soldiers that are being called to the banner. And then it says proudly exulting ones, suggesting that they have a kind of arrogance coming from their competence. And we saw that with respect to the statements that were made with respect to Assyria earlier, that Assyria had been given the task of marching on Israel and executing God's judgment on Israel. And they came, they were competent, that they were successful in all that they did, and as a result, they were arrogant, and God punished them for their arrogance. This seems to be a repeat of that we saw with respect to Assyria. There is a tumult on the mountains like that of many people, suggesting that this is an international kind of assembly of soldiers. A sound of the uproar of kingdoms, of nations gathered together. And it's the Lord of hosts that is mustering them for battle. So they're coming from all over, as we see later in verse 5, they're coming from a far country, from the farthest horizons, and the Lord and his instruments of indignation to destroy the whole land. So there we see their assignment is to go out, and they're supposed to destroy the whole land. Now the question is, what is the land? This is the Hebrew word here is unfortunately quite broad. It can mean a country. It can mean a geographical area. It can mean the whole earth. It can mean the dry land. So it has a wide range of meaning, and it's not clear what the meaning is here. But I would suggest that I think what's in view here is the whole land of that land that is going, that country that's going to be attacked, and we'll get to that in just a bit. It is interesting that we don't know yet who are the attackers, and we don't know who is going to be attacked. So it's just this ominous scene that we're envisioning, but none of the details yet. Next section. Wail, for the day of the Lord is near. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. Therefore, all hands will fall limp, and every man's heart will melt, and they will be terrified. Pains and anguish will take hold of them. They will writhe like a woman in labor. They will look at one another in astonishment, their faces aflame. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, cruel with fury and burning anger, to make the land a desolation, and he will exterminate its sinners from it. For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light. The sun will be dark when it rises, and the moon will not shed its light. Thus I will punish the world for its evil, and the wicked for their iniquity. I will also put an end to the arrogance of the proud, and abase the haughtiness of the ruthless. I will make mortal man scarcer than pure gold, and mankind than the gold of Ophir. Therefore I shall make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken from its place at the fury of the Lord of hosts in the day of his burning anger. And it will be that like a hunted gazelle, or like sheep with none to gather them, they will each turn to his own people, and each one flee to his own land. Anyone who is found will be thrust through, and anyone who is captured will fall by the sword. Their little ones also will be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be plundered, and their wives ravished. Okay, wail, for the day of the Lord is near. We've talked about on that day, and now we have the expression the day of the Lord. And thus far, my working hypothesis is that both of those phrases describe the same thing. And by the same thing, I mean that period of time when God chooses to act overtly in history to bring about his purposes. Now, well, I won't go further than that because it would predecide some of the interpretation that we'll talk about at the end. But I think the day of the Lord here is talking about the same thing as on that day. But it's possible that that's not true. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. Destruction here is the same, has the same root as the word for the Almighty. So it's kind of like, to try to capture that in English, it will come as a mighty blow from the Almighty. Might help capture that. But this is going to be God's hand at work. God is going to act overtly. And what's going to happen when God acts overtly? Everybody's hands will fall limp. Their heart will melt. They will be terrified. Pains and anguish will take hold of them. They'll writhe like a woman in labor. And they will look at one another in astonishment, their faces aflame. You can envision what's happening. It's one of those situations where it is so overwhelming, and you can kind of foresee the consequences of what's unfolding, and it looks hopeless. And people are looking at one another for comfort, and all they see in the eyes of the person next to them is the same hopelessness. Everyone is scared to death. What is going on here? It's the day of the Lord that's coming, cruel with fury and burning anger. It's going to make the land a desolation. He will exterminate its sinners from it. So this seems to be a day of judgment. God is going to act overtly. It's described as cruel with fury and burning anger. I have not done it, but I need to at some point go through and count the number of references to burning or fire in Isaiah, but it has to be very many. And he's going to act in such a way that he makes the land absolutely desolate. He devastates it. And what's exterminated from it is the sinners, suggesting a judgment kind of event. Verse 10 talks about things happening that cut off the light. The stars in the heaven and their constellations will no longer shine, and the sun will be dark, and the moon will not shed its light. So this event is causing the heavenly lights to no longer shine on the earth. Now, it could be that that's caused by smoke. That would make sense. We've seen reference to burning. We see judgment. It says it's a burn. God has a coming with a burning anger. It could very well be that this event is creating so much smoke that it has darkened the whole area. Then God says, I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will also put an end to the arrogance of the proud and debase the haughtiness of the ruthless. We've seen those themes before. The wicked will be punished, and arrogance will be put to an end. Verse 12, I will make mortal man scarcer than pure gold, and mankind than the gold of Ophir. This was the first verse that really gave me pause when I was going through this the first time. I will make mortal man scarcer than pure gold. It seems to be saying that human beings will be made rare, that there won't be many. It goes on, and mankind than the gold of Ophir. There just won't be many. Now, it could be that it's just with respect to this area that's being attacked. That could very well be. But that's pretty bold language in any case. Verse 13 continues with the bold language. Therefore, I shall make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken from its place at the fury of the Lord of hosts in the day of his burning anger. Once again, this is pretty bold language. We're talking about the heavens trembling and the earth being shaken from its place. The result of this, verse 14, like hunted gazelle, like sheep with no shepherd, people are just going to flee. They're going to run in every direction, running every which way. It says, and each one flee to his own land. I assume what that means is go back to, fleeing back to their homeland, that which is familiar, that which is comfortable, that the best place of being able to find safety, the most likely place to find safety. But, verses 15 and 16, anyone who is found will be thrust through. Anyone who is captured will fall by the sword. Their little ones will be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be plundered and their wives ravished. So it's a horrible scene that they are witnessing, with lots of people dying, lots of pain and suffering, despite their efforts to flee from it. Okay. When we get to the end of verse 16, we still don't know who is being attacked, and we don't know who the attackers are. But that becomes clearer in the next section. Behold, I am going to stir up the Medes against them, who will not value silver or take pleasure in gold, and their bows will mow down the young men. They will not even have compassion on the fruit of the womb, nor will their eye pity children. And Babylon, the beauty of kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It will never be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation. Nor will the Arab pitch his tent there. Nor will shepherds make their flocks lie down there. But desert creatures will lie down there, and their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches also will live there, and shaggy goats will frolic there. And hyenas will howl in their fortified towers, and jackals in their luxurious palaces. Her fateful time also will soon come, and her days will not be prolonged. So the attackers are the Medes. And who are the Medes? The Medes were a people group that developed in present-day Iran. They are closely related to the Persians. In fact, the Greeks didn't make a distinction between the Medes and the Persians. They called them all Medes. In 550, the Persians took control of the Medes. The way it happened was Cyrus, who was the grandson of the king of the Medes, overthrew his grandfather and took control in name of the Persians. So the Persians have conquered the Medes, but they're all pretty much one people. They speak the same language, they share the same culture, but the Persians become the dominant entity in 550. And in Greek literature in particular, the Medes had developed a reputation for not being interested in wealth. They're a very Spartan kind of culture that did not see value in accumulating wealth. And they had that reputation in the area. The Medes apparently are this people that's being gathered together to the banner that's been raised. And I should point out that the Medes and the Persians had put together an empire which was multinational. So the Medes are the ones who are attacking. And when it says, who will not value silver or take pleasure in gold, that's particularly ominous, because in the ancient world, if you were attacked, your best ace in the hole was, the worst case scenario, you pay off the invaders. You pay a good bribe to them, and you might be able to get away with your life. But this is a group of people that is not interested in wealth, so they will not be bribed. That sounds particularly ominous. It says their bows will mow down the young men. They will not even have compassion on the fruit of the womb, nor will their eye pity the children. They are killing everybody. They don't care the age. They are ruthless. And then we learn in verse 19 that the area that's being attacked is Babylon. The beauty of kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride. And Babylon was attacked and conquered by the Medo-Persian Empire in 539. And you probably remember that story, the river that went under the wall and into Babylon. That was the only way in, and they had it barred off, the Babylonians did, but the Medo-Persians diverted the river, so the water went way down, and then they were able to enter the city underneath the bars that were sticking down from the wall into the water. They went under those bars and into the city and were able to take it without meeting much defense, because the Babylonians thought that they were safe behind their walls. Babylon, the beauty of kingdoms, is going to be reduced to rubble, much like Sodom and Gomorrah had been reduced to rubble back in the time of Abraham. And what is being predicted here is that it will never be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation. Even Arabs won't pitch their tents there. Shepherds won't even come through the area. Only desert creatures will be in that area, and they will occupy the houses and the fortified towers and the luxurious palaces. The only thing that'll be there will be wild animals. And lastly, it says that the time is going to come soon, and her days will not be prolonged. As I've pointed out before, when it comes to prophecy in particular, God is a really bad judge of time. And so when he says it will come soon, doesn't help me much. So anybody who confuses a day in 1,000 years is time challenged. Okay. Now, next section, chapter 14, just the first couple of verses. When the Lord will have compassion on Jacob and again choose Israel and settle them in their own land, then strangers will join them and attach themselves to the house of Jacob, and the peoples will take them along and bring them to their place. And the house of Israel will possess them as an inheritance in the land of the Lord as male servants and female servants. And they will take their captors captive and will rule over their oppressors. Now, one of the things that's interesting in this 10-chapter section that we're in Isaiah is, on the one hand, it's proclaiming curses on the surrounding countries. But on the other hand, what it's proclaiming is really for domestic consumption. That is, these have been written for the people of Judah and the people of Israel. As a result, these curses that are being proclaimed on the surrounding countries, the enemies of Israel, woven in with that are promises being made to the people of Israel. Promises that talk about the glorious future that lies ahead for Israel. And this is one of those. The Lord will have compassion on Jacob and again choose Israel. The again here is interesting. What does it mean for God to choose them again? Well, it uses this verb for God to choose Israel with respect to when God decided to bring them out of Egypt. It says that God chose Israel. So it seems to be that when it's to suggest that God is going to choose them again, it means he's going to take action on their behalf again. And maybe it's more specific than that, take action on behalf of them to free them from slavery. That seems to be the context here, that he's going to bring them out from wherever they are. Strangers are going to join them and attach themselves to the house of Jacob. So it's going to be a combination of Jews and non-Jews who have attached themselves to Israel. And then in verse 2, and the peoples will take them along and bring them to their place. So it's the peoples then that are taking the initiative to get the Jews from where they were to their place. And the house of Israel will possess them as an inheritance in the land of the Lord, as male servants and female servants, and they will take their captors captive and they will rule over their oppressors. So now, those who attach themselves with Israel will be in a subservient position, and the people of Israel will be in the dominant position. They'll be in control. They'll be in mastery. They will rule over their oppressors. The situation that had been before, where the Jews were slaves to non-Jews, that is going to be inverted. Okay, next section. And it will be in the day when the Lord gives you rest from your pain and turmoil and harsh service in which you have been enslaved, that you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon and say, how the oppressor has ceased, and how fury has ceased. The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of rulers, which used to strike the peoples in fury with unceasing strokes, which subdued the nations in anger with unrestrained persecution. The whole earth is at rest and is quiet. They break forth into shouts of joy. Even the cypress trees rejoice over you, and the cedars of Lebanon, saying, since you were laid low, no tree cutter comes up against us. So in that day, and we've seen that phrase before, in that day, when the Lord gives you rest. So this is a time in history when God is giving rest to his people. And I think the term rest here is suggestive of other passages in the Old Testament. So rest from their pain and their turmoil and their harsh service in which they have been enslaved, suggesting that there will be no more pain, of the pain, turmoil, and harsh service and enslavement. In that day, that the people of Israel will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon. A commentary that I have found very helpful on Isaiah is by John Oswalt. There are a number of things that he has pointed out that I have found very helpful. And with respect to this passage, what he had to say was extremely helpful. The next 18 verses or so is in the form of a lament that would be proclaimed at the death of a king. That when a king would die, there's a genre of lament that would be proclaimed with respect to that king. And it would talk about all of the sadness, all the loss that's being experienced, but it would also point out all of the accomplishments of the king. In this case, it's turned on its head in that this is not bemoaning the death of the king of Babylon, but rather it's rejoicing at the death of the king of Babylon. So it's using the genre of a lament of the king's death, but it's expressing something just the opposite. He also points out that there are some similarities in some of the themes and some of the words that are used in this section to the suffering servant section coming up in Isaiah in chapters, 52 and 53. I'll just point that out. I'm not up to 52 or up to 53 yet. The oppressor has ceased, and how fury has ceased. So now there's a huge relief at the death of the king of Babylon that Israel is freed finally. And God has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers. So God has destroyed the power of those who have done evil, who have evil purposes. And with those staffs, the wicked and the evil used to strike people with fury and subdue the nations in anger with unrestrained persecution. So they use that power to just dominate other people unjustly. But now that God has broken that staff, the whole earth is at rest and is quiet. Now I'll just point out that again, the word for earth here is that Hebrew word that can mean either land or it can mean the whole world, it can mean the earth. So the translators of the New American Standard have decided that this is more global than it necessarily is, because it's possible that it would say the whole land is at rest. But the whole earth is at rest and is quiet. They break forth into shouts of joy. So there's exultation over the death, the demise of the king of Babylon. And then it talks about the cypress trees rejoicing and the cedars of Lebanon. If you'll recall, there are a couple of instances that we've already encountered in Isaiah where a nation was likened to a forest. And the Assyrians coming in was like cutting down all the trees. And now we have the forest exulting because there are no more tree cutters. There are no more imperialists. Next section. Sheol from beneath is excited over you to meet you when you come. It arouses for you the spirits of the dead, all the leaders of the earth. It raises all the kings of the nations from their thrones. They will all respond and say to you, even you have been made weak as we. You have become like us. Your pomp and the music of your harps have been brought down to Sheol. Maggots are spread out as your bed beneath you, and worms are your covering. How you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn. You have been cut down to the earth, you who have weakened the nations. But you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. Nevertheless, you will be thrust down to Sheol, to the recesses of the pit. So, Sheol, hell, is excited at the prospect of the king of Babylon coming into its domain. And it arouses all the spirits of the dead kings, all the leaders of the earth. They're all there to greet the king of Babylon. And what they say is, even you have been made weak as we. You have become like us. Again, it's interesting language suggestive of language earlier in the Old Testament. And we see even more of that when it says in verse 13, but you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. That the king of Babylon aspired to a kind of God-likeness, to ascending to the throne of God. Those were his aspirations, but what has happened, the reality has been that the king of Babylon has been made weak like the dead kings. He has descended down to Sheol. He's powerless. Your pomp and the music of your harps have been brought down to Sheol, and maggots spread out as your bed beneath you, and worms are your covering. He aspired to the very highest, but what has happened is the opposite of it. Verse 13, I mentioned that you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit in the mount of the assembly in the recesses of the north. The word recesses here can mean the extremes. So the farthest north, and that seems to be the height of heavens. So that's what he said in his heart. He also said, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, and I will make myself like the Most High. So he aspired to God-likeness. But what's the reality? He's thrust down into hell, into the the other recesses, not the recesses at the height of heaven, but the recesses, the extremes of the pit of hell. Okay, last part. Those who see you will gaze at you. They will ponder over you, saying, "Is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a wilderness and overthrew its cities, who did not allow his prisoners to go home? All the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb. But you have been cast out of your tomb like a rejected branch, clothed with the slain who are pierced with a sword, who go down to the stones of the pit like a trampled corpse. You will not be united with them in burial because you have ruined your country. You have slain your people. May the offspring of evildoers not be mentioned forever. Prepare for his sons a place of slaughter because of the iniquity of their fathers. They must not arise and take possession of the earth and fill the face of the world with cities." Well, I'll stop there. So now it's kind of switching, and we're looking from the perspective of those who are walking by and viewing the dead body, I think. So this seems to be a point in the, what's supposed to be a lament, where the people are, at least in imagination, walking by the dead body. "They will ponder over you, saying, 'Is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms?'" He doesn't look awesome anymore. He doesn't look fearsome anymore. He's just a corpse. What did he accomplish? He made the earth tremble. He shook kingdoms. He made the world like a wilderness. He overthrew its cities, and he did not allow his prisoners to go home. His accomplishments are all negative accomplishments rather than positive accomplishments. And as a result, unlike most kings who are placed by their people in tombs of honor, he's going to be cast out of his tomb. And then it says, like a rejected branch, which is a curious thing because we have seen reference to the Messiah as a branch. But here we see the king of Babylon like a rejected branch at the end of his life. That's his destiny, a rejected branch. The Messiah, on the other hand, the branch is just the beginning, and it's full of promise and life and grows into something truly impressive. He's clothed with the slain who are pierced with a sword and who go down with the stones of the pit. So it's dead corpses that enshroud him, and presumably it's the dead corpses that he had killed that are weighing him down into the pit of hell. "You will not be united with them in burial because you have ruined your country. You have slain your people. May the offspring of evildoers not be mentioned forever." So rather than having made a name for himself that people will mention in fondness and respect and honor, he will not be mentioned forever. He will be forgotten. Then verse 21 is interesting. "Prepare for his sons a place of slaughter. Because of the iniquity of their fathers, they must not arise and take possession of the earth and fill the face of the world with cities." So what it's saying is, prepare a place for all of his heirs to power. They need to all be killed so that this does not happen again. Never again must the king of Babylon possess the earth and fill the face of the world with cities. That's what kings of Babylon do. They fill the earth with cities, and that must not happen. Okay, last two verses. "And I will rise up against them, declares the Lord of hosts, and will cut off from Babylon name and survivors, offspring and posterity, declares the Lord. I will also make it a possession for the hedgehog and the swamps of water, and I will sweep it with the broom of destruction, declares the Lord of hosts." Okay. I have mentioned before, from my perspective, what is the problem in interpreting prophecy. The first is what should be interpreted as figurative language and what should be interpreted as being literal language. The second challenge is if it's predictive prophecy, and not all prophecy is predictive, but if it's predictive prophecy, what is the chronological order of those events that have been predicted? That becomes very difficult. And then the third challenge is how do you identify those events in history which are the fulfillment of that which was predicted? And that those are the three challenges with respect to prophecy, at least as I've identified them so far. And in particular in this one, I think that these chapters are predictive. The question is, how can we match these up with events in history? Now, I told you that I was interpreting one way, and then I changed my mind at the end of it. I decided that it just wasn't working. The way that I was headed initially was to read this as talking about the Babylon of the time of Isaiah, the Babylon that came into being 100 years later, emerged as a world power, ended up conquering Judah and taking many from Judah into captivity back to Babylon, but then it was conquered by the Medo-Persians. So I was taking it as being that as being the fulfillment of the events that are described here. Babylon was taken by the Medes in 539. Interestingly, it was not vacated as a city until 275. In 275 BC, it was finally vacated. It had shrunk dramatically, but in 275, it was completely vacated. And as far as I can tell, it has never been resettled since. I was reading about it online. It's interesting. It's about 50 miles south of Baghdad, but the Tigris and Euphrates rivers have changed their course over the passage of history, and the area where Babylon is located has become quite swampy now. As a result, it's difficult to build there. It's not it wouldn't be a pleasant place to live. Saddam Hussein, Baghdad's located in Iraq, Saddam Hussein, who aspired to be another Nebuchadnezzar, wanted to rebuild Babylon and started the project of doing so. There was construction that was done there. There was a big palace that was being constructed for him personally. But that construction was interrupted by the Gulf War, and nothing has been done since. Well, the only construction that occurred since then was the U.S. cleared an area in Babylon and made a camp there and used it for a helicopter landing space. Okay, so it has been vacated since 275 and has not been reestablished as a city. But the problem that I ran into is there is just too much in the passage that has language that seems to go beyond just talking about the Babylon of 500 BC. And I pointed out the mortal man scarcer than gold and earth will be shaken from its place. And there are others as well. It seems to be talking in more lofty terms than just the conquest of Babylon. Furthermore, we see in chapter 14, which I take to be related, some bigger themes being referred to. The rest of Israel, entering into the rest, Israel will enter into its rest. Well, the rest is a very significant theme in the Old Testament. And ultimately, the rest is that state in which sin has been dealt with and eradicated, and we rest from our struggle with sin. And another theme, and I emphasize this going through, when it says, and fill the face of the world with cities, that the king of Babylon's heirs need to all be killed so that the world cannot again be filled with cities. Well, cities is a theme that develops in the Old Testament, and the first one to have built a city was Cain. And then cities are kind of, you follow that theme through, and the city becomes the concentration point in human existence. It's where human evil is concentrated. Cities become kind of symbolic of human rebellion against God. I'm sure that I've mentioned this before, and there are others who have mentioned it before, but the book by Jacques Ellul, The Meaning of City, is a very interesting book, and that's where he talks and traces this theme of city through the Old Testament, and I have found that very interesting. So I'm inclined to think at this point that this is not just talking about the Babylon of 500 BC, but it's talking about Babylon in a different sense. Now, how do you interpret this then? How do we go about this? And what I'm proposing is that I think there's only one way to do it, and that is you look at the clues in the text and you put them side by side with your knowledge of the world that's out there. And is there any way that the clues in the text line up with the realities that are out there that would help us to understand what this would look like when it comes to pass? Now, it could be that we are so far from this coming to pass that there's not much out there that we can line up with the clues in the text. That's a very real possibility. But all we've got is what's out there as best we can see it and know it. And so I'm going to try to line up the clues in the text with what's out there that we can see today. So what is meant by Babylon? Well, if we go geographically, the thing that would match would be Iraq. Is Iraq what's in mind here? And I think that's an unlikely candidate, at least at this time. But if Iraq is the fulfillment of this, if Iraq is the Babylon that it's talking about, it's going to be a while before that comes around. Is there another candidate? And I think another candidate would be that a Babylon in spirit, that is a Babylon, that which has the spirit of the first great civilization, Babylon. And what would have that spirit? What would embody that spirit? And as I look out, I think the best candidate is essentially Western culture. It's the epitome of civilization at this point. What's developed in America and Europe has become kind of the gold standard of culture in the world today. And it's not just because America is powerful, America and Europe are powerful, that has become true. It isn't always the case that a militarily powerful country becomes a culturally powerful country. Think about the Soviet Union. Militarily powerful, culturally insignificant. But the United States and the Western culture, the United States and Europe, has become militarily powerful, but also culturally powerful. That everybody in the world, to one degree or another, wants to identify itself with Western culture, with the exception of one group, and we'll get to that in just a second. Babylon was seen as the pinnacle of culture, the pinnacle of sophistication. Even when it wasn't powerful, it was seen as the pinnacle of sophistication. And I think that the best heir to that in the modern world is Europe and America. And we've seen that culture go literally worldwide. It has globalized economically as well as financially and in other ways. And this is a topic that we could get into at great length, but as Karl Marx pointed out, in particular the economic system, but also the economic and political system that developed in Europe and in the United States, was of such a nature that it forced other countries to conform themselves to this. And that has happened. That other countries in the world have had to conform themselves to Western culture for economic reasons primarily. And so it has forced itself onto the rest of the world. And it is a whole different set of values. It is a whole different way of life. Those countries that came late to industrialization, they have to go through a brutal process of transforming their culture, their society, in a relatively short period of time. And that's a very difficult thing to do. It's a traumatic thing to do. And yet, there are cultures all over the world that have gone through that transformation because they had to become westernized. So that's my best guess, that what it's talking about when it says Babylon is modern Western culture. What does he mean by the Medes? Well, here I'm inclined, I don't know, Iran is the area where the Medes came from. Are we talking about Iran? Maybe. Could it be more broadly, not just Iran, but the Shiites? Maybe. Could it be broader than that? Could it be Islam? Maybe. I'm not really sure. At the height of the Median Empire, it stretched from Iran through northern Syria, northern Iraq, and into Turkey. So it would have been that belt that was all part of the Median Empire. And then the Persian Empire, it expanded even beyond that. So I'm not sure, but I'm inclined to think that the Medes, the best match for the Medes, as far as I can see it right now, would be Islam as a whole. And if that's true, then the verse that I told you I didn't know what it meant, I will still tell you I don't know what it means, but verse 2 of chapter 13, where it says, "Wave the hand that they may enter the doors of the nobles," that could be suggesting a popular movement, a grassroots movement that is anti-aristocratic, anti-rulers. And that could then match what's happening in the Islamic world. In the Islamic world, one of the things that we're seeing is an intense hatred of the Western world and an animosity to everything that the Western world stands for, such that were radical Islam to conquer the Western world, they would not be likely to resurrect it. They want to clean the slate. They want to get rid of that. So they wouldn't be doing the city building that Western culture has done. And they don't care about money. They're driven by religious motivation. They aren't driven by financial considerations. They aren't going to conquer and to pillage as much as I understand, the motivation of radical Islam would be to destroy. Okay. If that's right, then what's being predicted would be an assault by radical Islam on Western culture that would bring it to its knees. Is that possible? And I think the answer is yes. I really do think it's possible. Osama bin Laden being asked about Western culture after what happened in Afghanistan when the Soviet Union left Afghanistan, he said, "The most difficult enemy has been defeated. The second will be easier." The most difficult one, who's that? The USSR. Who's the easier one? The West. He says it has a soft underbelly. And I think what he means by that is it doesn't have the stick-to-itiveness, the ruthlessness that the Soviet Union had. And I think that's absolutely true. And what is the weakness of the West? As we look at world powers, what's the weakness of the West? I think the answer is our economy. That we have the best military in the world. I don't think there's any question about that. But for us to wage a prolonged conflict is absolutely dependent upon a solid economy. If our economy goes south, if our economy grinds to a halt, we can't conduct a war on an extended period of time. So I think that's my best guess as to what scenario is being predicted here, is something along those lines, that radical Islam would find a way to undermine Western culture, and that would be worldwide Western culture. And I think it would be bringing the economy to a grinding halt. And if it were to bring our economy to a grinding halt, we would have the kind of astonishment and the kind of look in the eyes that it was talking about when people look at each other and what are we going to do? Because it will be traumatic. Well, I used up my whole time, but let's do a few questions. We really need time for a few questions, and we'll.
David, one thing that came to mind to me when waved the hand, and then when you spoke about radical Islam, is the in academia and so on, the rejection of Western culture, like Greek and so on. I see it as kind of a doubling, like one, there's a disrespect for our own culture, and then a hatred of this culture going hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's true. What's happened is, I think that we have developed a self-hatred, and that really undermines us as a culture, such that we are really exposed. One of the things that I found interesting when I was in the Soviet Union, this was before the fall of the Soviet Union, I was talking to one of my roommates who was, he was the president of the Komsomol, the Communist Youth League at the University of Leningrad State University, LSU. I can't remember what they're ranked right now, but he said to me at one point, he was drunk, and as a result, I think he was being particularly honest, but he said, there are no more true believers in the Soviet Union. He said, if you ask people, if they're honest with you, they're going to say that they don't believe in the Soviet system anymore, that you just become a member of the party in order to get ahead. So what happened to the Soviet Union was they had horrible economic problems, but they also had a moral problem. That is, nobody believed in it anymore. And I think we're running into that same kind of problem, that we have undermined ourselves as well. That is, we no longer value what we have, such that I really think that if you were to ask the average person, average American, would you be willing to die to save this country? I don't think the majority would say yes, if they're going to be honest.
Well, I see it also in politics. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go much into that. Yeah, and then I wanted to ask you something now. One thing you're talking about, like who is Babylon and the Medes and so on, it's when talks about, I think it's 14:12, where it says, yeah, oh, Lucifer. Uh-huh. I just wondered, what's the interpretation of that? Because I've heard a lot of people like, oh, this is Satan. Mm-hmm. And some say, no, this is a man who was possessed by Satan. Mm-hmm. So can you speak a little bit on that, or you want to save that? Or?
I don't know that I want to save it, but I can't speak on it.
Okay.
I really don't know at this point, and this gets even more complicated. Let me save it, because I think it will come up again.
You were talking about how the day of the Lord and those phrases refer to God overtly acting.
Right.
So how do you distinguish or between what, I mean, it seems like God is in charge of everything. So this doesn't seem to be a miraculous thing that he's doing, like parting the Red Sea or something. Mm-hmm. It seems like it's just using, you know, one culture against another, right, to fulfill his purposes. So how do you define or distinguish between when God is overtly acting or when it's just, mm-hmm, you know, what's normally happening, mm-hmm, in the cultures?
Right, right. Let's take something like the establishment of modern Israel. There's nothing involved there that defies the laws of physics and chemistry. And yet, from my perspective, there's no question but God's fingerprints are all over that. But that's God's activity. And in that day, and in the day of the Lord, I think what it's describing is a whole bunch of events that have God's fingerprints all over them. Now, could they be supernatural? Some of them could absolutely be supernatural. But I don't think that that's absolutely required. What's required is that it be, to someone who is open to it, they will be able to see that that has God's fingerprints all over it.
So often you hear people saying, Hurricane Katrina, you know, that was God's punishment on whatever, you know, or 9/11, that was God's punishment on America for whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like it's easy to read, you know, that this is God overtly acting because of whatever.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, I don't think we should jump to those kinds of conclusions.
I agree.
But
I think it best to be conservative with respect to those kinds of things and not jump to that conclusion. But there, especially when things that God has said will come to pass, that all the pieces come together and it happens, I would say that has God's fingerprints on it. And that's what I would expect to see as God moves, as God, I'm not positive that we're at that point in time where these things are falling together. It may be another 100 years, it may be a millennium yet. But if we are getting to that point in time, then we're going to see God kind of acting in a way that is, I think, recognizable as his activity. Let's do one more and then I better let people go.
I'm finding myself, even when we're doing Bible studies in the New Testament and trying to figure out what was happening and going on in people's minds and mm-hmm. what the apostles and the disciples were mm-hmm. arguing about and against. And I more and more I think it's sounding like they're talking about us today. And in today's, when you were going through this, I'm thinking, what's going on here? I mean, what's happening and when and where and then when you take that and which happened a long, long time ago mm-hmm. and now you're trying to bring it up to in today's thing, could it possibly be talking about something that's happening today or in the near future? A lot of times when we read the Old Testament and even the New Testament, we think it's happening so long ago that we can't really relate to it, or we don't want to relate to it, right. When in reality, we haven't invented sin. We haven't done anything to improve on the way we sin. I mean, it's always been there, mm-hmm. and it's just there. What God was talking about in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, it's something that you just can't flick off. I mean, it's talking about where we're at today, too. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so I thought it was really interesting when you brought it up to date, because so often it's so easy when we look at Israel and the Old Testament and just thinking that it happened so long ago that it really doesn't jump to where we're at today, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yes, yes. If we are anywhere near the end of history, what a privileged place to be. To be in a situation where you can look back at the story that God has told and see some of those themes coming together, that's a thrilling thing to be able to witness. And there's a sense in which it makes the last four millennia kind of shrink up. And that people writing in the time of Abraham, people writing in the time of Paul, weren't all that long ago. You can see that all in perspective, and the themes are the same. People are the same. Sin is the same. God is the same. And but to see all of that played out on the stage of history, that's a phenomenal privilege to look back at all of that and be able to see the train coming down the track. Okay, thanks.